to Ricky Jin's Old Time Radio. We have a cracker of a show for you tonight, gals and gents. Wash your black heads, sniff some borax, and enjoy this episode of Suspense entitled The Dead Sea Blightly.
This is the Man in Black, here again to introduce Columbia's program, Suspense. Our stars this evening are three. The order of their appearance, they are Walter Hampton, one of the theater's proudest names for two generations, and Susan Hayward and Lee Bowman, two of Hollywood's brightest younger stars. The story called The Dead Sleep Lightly by John Dixon Carr is tonight's tale of suspense. If you've been with us on these Tuesday nights, you will know that suspense is compounded of mystery and suspicion and dangerous adventure. In this series are tales calculated to intrigue you, to stir your nerves, to offer you a precarious situation, and then withhold the solution until the last possible moment. And so, with The Dead Sleep Lightly, and with the performances of Walter Hampton, Susan Hayward, and Lee Bowman, we again hope to keep you in suspense.
Ashes to ashes and dust to dust.
Meadowvale Cemetery, not far from New York. Meadowvale Cemetery, on a dim gray morning in early April, when rain forms a mist across leafless trees and white gravestones. You see, over there, the group of silk-hatted gentlemen, each with his protecting umbrella, gathered around an open grave. You see the clay soil freshly dug. You can hear, perhaps, the creaking of support as the coffin is lowered into its everlasting house. And the droning voice of the surgeon.
I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth on me, though he were dead, yet shall he live.
Live?
Quiet, Mr. Templeton, please.
What's wrong with old Templeton?
Please, sir, remember where you are.
She's not alive, I tell you. She's not alive.
It might seem a long distance, that, from the Cosmopolites Club in Gramercy Park on the following evening, when that same well-fed man, as hard and unemotional as the diamond pin in his tie, hurries up the steps into the club then.
Yes,
Mr. Templeton?
Tell me, Mr. Wilmot in the club, do you know?
Yes, sir. Don't you see him?
See him? Where?
In the lounge over there, sir, sitting by the fire.
Yes, yes, of course. I'm a little upset. You're a good fellow, Henry. I won't forget you.
Thank you, sir. Excuse me, sir, but aren't you going to take off your hat and overcoat?
Never mind my hat and coat. Just tell me one other thing. When I came into the club, was there anybody following me?
Following you, Mr. Templeton?
Yes, a woman. A woman with a long skirt and a heavy black veil.
There aren't many women who wear that kind of dress nowadays, sir.
Look out into the street. Do you see anybody?
No, sir. There's just
What's that?
Oh, that's only the old street musician, sir. He doesn't mean any harm.
I won't have that tune played, you hear? I'm used to getting my orders obeyed, and I'm going to have this one obeyed. Here's some money. Go out and tell him to go away.
Yes, sir, if you insist, but
do as you're told and don't ask questions. If anybody wants me, I shall be with Mr. Wilmot.
Very good, sir.
Good evening, Wilmot. Mind if I sit down for a minute?
Why, not at all. Pull up a chair. Have some coffee?
No, thanks. I'll get down to brass tacks right away.
Yes, you always do. I've noticed that.
Well, I'm a pretty self-sufficient kind of a fellow, Wilmot. I made a name for myself, even if I do say it myself. But, well, the fact is,
I need advice. A successful publisher asking advice from one of his own authors. That's something new, isn't it?
Now, look here, Wilmot, I'm serious.
All right, I take it back. What's on your mind?
Well, you've studied what we'll call the supernatural, haven't you?
I've lectured and written books about it, yes.
And did you ever meet a ghost?
No, I can't say I ever did. Have you?
It might only be my own imagination. Yes, that's what scares me. You get on in years, and your arteries harden, and you don't take enough exercise, and you think something ought to be done about your waistline, but you never bother. You see, Wilmot, I went to a funeral yesterday.
You did? Whose funeral was it?
The person who died has nothing to do with this. It was old Simpson of Hawley and Sons. We thought it was only decent to make up a party and go to the funeral. And I took my secretary along, a girl named Molly Carroll. I'm leaving for Washington tomorrow. Besides, I'm moving house. So there was a lot of work to do. What I couldn't stand was that infernal cemetery in the rain. And we must have gone in by the wrong gate, because we were in a neglected, desolate part of the cemetery where the rank grass grew over the grave.
You'll oblige me, Miss Carroll, if you first find out the proper directions about places. We've come in the wrong gate to the cemetery.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Templeton. I thought you
But your thought doesn't matter now. This is the wrong part of the cemetery. My shoes are absolutely ruined with wet clay.
Well, it isn't doing my own shoes and stockings any good either, Mr. Templeton.
If there's been any damage to them, Miss Carroll, I'll replace them. You never found me ungenerous now, have you?
Well, not exactly ungenerous, no.
I'll pay you the compliment, Miss Carroll, saying that you're the best secretary I ever had.
Thank you.
Yet you want to leave me.
Yes, I want to get married.
That's what Mr. Barnes is telling me. And who is this paragon of yours? What does he do? Does he make any money?
Well, Frank's a radio technician. He's not very wealthy, I'll admit.
Wealthy? A radio technician? I bet he doesn't make as much as I pay you. Yet you want to get married.
Well, is there anything very strange about that?
Yes, if it interferes with your career, if it... Good Lord. Look at that.
Look at what, Mr. Templeton?
Over there, where I'm pointing.
You mean that? It's only an old gravestone covered with weeds and brambles.
I haven't seen that grave in years.
It looks rather neglected.
It is neglected, isn't it? Will you go closer, please, and read the inscription?
Mr. Templeton...
Do as I tell you, please.
It says, let's see if I can get some of these weeds aside. It says, sacred to the memory of Mary Ellen Cleaver, born September 5th, 1892, departed this life March 25th, 1919. Thou shouldst still be adored as this moment thou art, let thy loveliness fade as it will. If you lower that umbrella, Mr. Templeton, you'll get soaking wet.
Sentimental trash. But she always liked it.
She always liked it?
Mary Ellen Cleaver.
Did you know her?
Very well indeed. She was my wife.
Your wife? But I never knew you were married.
Neither does anybody else. Where's my flask of brandy? What have I done with it?
It's in your hip pocket, Mr. Templeton, but do you think that's very wise? You've already had more than enough.
Whatever I do is wise, Miss Carroll. Well, we were married very young. She was a nice little thing. I was fond of her, yes. But she couldn't have helped me. I'm not a snob, but she wasn't in my class. No style, you know, no manners, no education.
Indeed.
Could I have introduced her to the friends I was making? No. Wouldn't have been kind to her. She didn't even want to go to the places where I was invited. She'd sit at home and say, what was it like? Did you have a nice time? What was Mrs. So-and-so wearing? And... she loved me. I'll put that to her credit. But...
you left her?
I thought it was the kindest thing to do, yes. She went away. Then I heard she'd had...
had what?
Nothing. Doesn't matter. Well, there was a war on. I attended the peace conference in Europe. Never even knew she was dead until I heard some friends had buried her. I always promised to call her up. She said she'd come back to me if I did.
Well... you couldn't call her up now, Mr. Templeton, even if you wanted to.
No, I suppose not. But I was fond of her. I wish there was something I could do.
Well, you could have her grave cared for. Have some flowers put on it.
That's it. That's an idea. She'd have liked that. Can you take care of that for me?
I'll look after it tomorrow morning, Mr. Templeton.
But how will they ever be able to locate the grave? There must be thousands in this cemetery.
Oh, each grave has a number, you know, cut into the stone so you can identify it. This is number 1212.
1212. Sounds like a telephone number, doesn't it?
Yes, doesn't it?
Meadowvale 1212. Poor girl. I was fond of her.
Please, Mr. Templeton, come along and please, no more brandy. You've got a funeral to attend.
And then, Wilmot, the night came. And the horror.
What horror? Take it easy, man. There's nothing to worry about. You were sitting here in the Cosmopolites Club.
Yes, but I wasn't sitting in the club last night. I was on my way home.
And why should that scare you?
I don't know, but it did. I'd been jumpy all day. That infernal number kept running through my head. Meadowvale, 1212. Have you ever seen my house?
Yes, it's that big sham Gothic place on Riverside Drive, isn't it?
Yes, big and dark and drafty like a mausoleum. I told you I was moving house to an apartment downtown. But there were some papers there. I had to get out of the safe in the library to take with me to Washington tomorrow. I knew the servants would be gone, of course. But I hoped Mrs. Bloom, that's my housekeeper, would still be there. Then, when I went up the park, about 6:30...
Meadowvale 1212.
Mr. Templeton, this is a surprise. Sorry to trouble you, Mr. Bloom. I seem to have mislaid my key. The other could have sworn I had it on the key ring this morning.
It's no trouble, Mr. Templeton. Only, I hope you're not planning to spend the night here.
No, I'm going to a hotel. Why do you ask?
Because they've disconnected everything except the electricity and taken away most of the furniture.
I haven't touched anything in the library.
No, sir. I told them you said to leave that. But it does seem a pity in a way.
What seems a pity?
To break up a lovely home like this after all these years.
Home? This big, ugly picture gallery?
It's been a home to me, sir.
Well, I've treated you generously, haven't I?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
I've got several hours' work to do, Mrs. Bloom. A whole safe full of papers to sort over. I'm going to the library and... What's that you're hiding behind your back?
I'm not hiding anything, sir.
All the same, what is it?
It's only a music box, sir. I found it in the attic when the moving men were here. If I hadn't known there were... Well, no ladies in your life, I'd have said it belonged to one of them. I love to hear them, sir. May I?
Mrs. Bloom!
Yes, sir?
If you don't want me to smash that music box, turn it off.
Yes, sir, I'm sure I'd never...
I'm going to the library. If you can find any sandwiches and coffee, bring them.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me. Same old library. Same old... claw-footed desk. There's the Venetian mirror she bought for you. Look at yourself in the mirror, Templeton. Admit you can't face it. Admit you can't work here tonight. Admit you've got to have lights and music and... That's it. Go out for dinner. Telephone Wilmot. If they've let the phone... Oh, yes. Good. Here it is. Hello, hello.
Yes, sir. Number, please.
Number, please. I want, Meadowvale 1212.
Meadowvale 1212.
Wait, what the devil's name am I saying? Change that, I want...
Hello, my darling. I knew you'd call me when you needed me.
Who's that speaking? Who are you?
It's Mary Ellen, dear. Don't you recognize my voice?
You're not Mary Ellen. This is a trick. Mary Ellen is dead.
Yes, dear. But the dead sleep lightly. And they can be lonely, too. And now that you do need me...
I don't need you. I don't need anybody.
I'm coming back to join you, dear. It's not easy, but I'll be there by the time the clock strikes 7. I'll wear a veil because I don't look very pretty.
I won't have this. I won't listen to you. I
Goodbye,
won't...
Goodbye, my dear. Remember, when the clock strikes 7...
Mrs. Bloom! Mrs. Bloom!
Mr.
Mr. Templeton, what on earth is the matter?
Who's been playing tricks on me?
Tricks, sir, I don't understand.
Who spoke to me on this phone?
But, sir, nobody could have spoken to you on that phone.
Nobody could have? What are you talking about?
That phone's disconnected, sir.
Disconnected?
Yes, sir. The man came here this afternoon and took that little metal box off the wall and rolled all the wires up and put everything on the desk there. Said he'd be back tomorrow to take it away.
Mrs. Bloom, that's impossible.
Look for yourself, sir. You're standing in the middle of the room holding that phone, and the wires don't lead anywhere.
That's true.
So you couldn't very well have talked to anybody on the phone that wasn't connected? Now, could you?
I tell you, I got the operator. I heard it ring. I talked to someone else.
Oh? And what did that person say?
She said she'd be here to visit me when...
Templeton, what's the matter?
And so, Wilmot, that's what happened last night. The phone was disconnected. It was Mary Ellen's voice. There's no doubt about that. Am I out of my mind or what?
Before I say anything about that, my friend.
Well?
Let's hear the end of your story. What did happen when the clock struck 7?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No, I lost my head. Ran out of that house as though the devil were after me. Maybe he was.
And since then?
I spent the night at the hotel. Today, I've walked past that house 50 times, 100 times, trying to muster up enough nerve to go in. I couldn't do it, but I've got to go in there.
Why?
It's those papers I've got to take to Washington.
Send somebody else to get them.
I can't do that, Wilmot. It's confidential information for the government. I've thought of everything. I've even bought a revolver, see?
For the love of heaven, man, put that gun away. You want the other club members to think you have gone insane?
Then I thought of you. You know all the tricks of fake spiritualists. You've written about it and lectured about it.
Yeah, which reminds me, by the way, that I'm lecturing before the Acropolis Club in about 20 minutes.
You've got to break that engagement, Wilmot.
Why?
Because you're going with me to my house tonight, now.
Oh, that's impossible, old man. Now sit quietly and listen to me. I'll go with you willingly, tomorrow morning.
That's too late. I'm taking an early plane to Washington.
Well, then wait until I can get away from the lecture. Say, around midnight. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take a taxi and join you as soon as I can.
That won't do. I've got to know the answer now. Do you understand?
Aren't you being a little unreasonable about this?
Unreasonable or not, I usually get my own way, and I mean to have it now.
Well, then I'm afraid you'll have to go to the house alone. Besides...
You know, Wilmot, you worry me. You sit there puffing at that pipe and looking at me out of those queer eyes of yours like a young Satan. I've often wondered what you were really thinking about.
Since you flatter my intelligence so much, I was wondering whether you'd been quite frank with me.
Frank with you how?
About your late wife, Mary Ellen Kleber.
What about her?
Well, after she left you, something happened that, you don't like to talk about. Was there, by any chance, a child, a son, for instance?
Did you say a son?
Yes.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, then let's agree not to understand each other, shall we?
Now, are you coming with me or aren't you?
I tell you, man, I'll get there as soon as I can.
All I can think about is the wet red clay in that cemetery and the dismal grave in the rain and what her face might look like if she raised the veil. And what am I going to see in that house? What am I going to see in that house?
The clocks chime, the hours dwindle, the traffic roar of the city sinks to a low growl behind twinkling lights. It is midnight when a taxi moves along a certain street towards a certain house out of a bygone age. Lightless, black against the stars, surrounded by iron railings and with a path bordered by fir trees leading to the front door. Look, too, with the face of Mr. Patrick Wilmot when that taxi draws near.
All right, driver. This is the place.
I'll be in waiting for you, sir.
No, you needn't wait. Keep the change.
Thank you, sir. Good night.
So the front gate is open. And he did go in. And I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to bump into you.
Mr. Wilmot.
You know who I am.
Oh, yes. I've seen you several times at our office. I'm Molly Carroll, Mr. Templeton's secretary.
What are you doing here?
Well, it's Mr. Templeton.
What about him?
Well, that's what I want to know. I was out with Frank, that's my fiancé, and when I got home, the girl I room with said that Mr. Templeton had been phoning and phoning all evening. She said he sounded drunk or something. He wanted somebody to go with him to this house.
Evidently, I wasn't the only person he applied to. Shall we go in?
Yes, but the whole house is dark. Suppose he isn't there.
He's there, all right. You don't know men like Bert Templeton.
But I...
I'll push the gate wider. Now, straight up the walk to the front door. I've got a flashlight.
What are we going to find?
Something rather unpleasant. I'd better warn you.
How do you know?
I have my ways of knowing, Miss Carroll.
Oh, look.
What is it?
That French window to the left of the front door.
Yes.
It's partly open.
Well, there's nothing in that, necessarily. Templeton said he'd lost his key. He might have had to open a window.
Oh, that's true, but...
So you see it, too, do you?
See what?
There's a footprint across the sill of that French window. A footprint made in wet clay.
It's like the clay of the cemetery.
So I should imagine. Will you go in first, or shall I?
Into that dark room? I will not.
Well, then stay here, please, until I get some lights on.
No, wait. I'll go. Let me take your arm.
All right, be careful now. Yes, I thought so. This room is the library. And there are more footprints of somebody or something walking in. They lead... Who's there? Who's there?
It's only me, sir. Mrs. Bloom, the housekeeper.
Then what's the idea of standing in a dark room in the middle of the night with what sounds like...
It's only a music box, sir. I left it behind along with some other things and came back to get them. I've got my own key. I thought I heard a noise in here.
But why aren't there any lights?
The electricity's cut off, sir. It was cut off today.
I see. Templeton is here, or was here. He must have had some kind of light. If I turn this flashlight on the desk, maybe...
Ah!
Be quiet, Miss Carroll!
What is it, sir? I'm as blind as a bat without my glasses.
It's Mr. Templeton. He's lying on the floor beside the desk.
Oh, he isn't...
No, he isn't dead. His face is the color of putty. I think he's had some kind of stroke. We'd better not take any chances. Mrs. Bloom?
Yes, sir.
Get outside to the nearest telephone and call for an ambulance. Tell him it's an emergency case.
You're Mr. Wilmot, aren't you? But what's happened to him?
Ask a dead woman.
I beg your pardon.
Never mind. Hurry.
Of course I'll hurry, Mr. Wilmot. What are we going to do?
Well, let's have a look around. Templeton seems to have been working at his papers by the light of a couple of candles, which somebody's blown out. We'll relight them. There's the desk. There's all the papers scattered round
him. Mr. Wilmot, please. What happened to him?
I'll tell you. As he sat there in the dim light of two candles, a ghostly figure appeared at that French window. It wore a long, old-fashioned skirt and a heavy black veil to hide the face. It walked toward Templeton, tracking graveyard clay. It stretched its arms to him like this.
Keep away from me, please.
Templeton couldn't stand it. He collapsed. And now, before the old housekeeper returns, would you care to hear how the whole trick was worked?
Trick? What trick?
Have you heard about the ghost voice that talked on a disconnected telephone?
Oh, yes. Yes, he said something about it this morning, but I thought he wasn't himself.
He wasn't, but he heard it. Remember Mrs. Bloom's story about the telephone man?
Yes.
They don't send a man round to yank the whole apparatus off the wall, put it on the desk, and say he'll be back for it next day. This man from the telephone company was an imposter.
The man from the telephone company was an imposter?
Exactly.
Oh, look, he's moving his hand. He's trying to open his eyes. Isn't there anything we can do for him?
No, there's nothing we can do till the doctor arrives. In the meantime, listen to me.
All right. What did this imposter do?
He took away the real phone and substituted a spirit telephone. You don't know what a spirit telephone is?
No, of course not.
It's an old device used by fake mediums. You see a telephone without wires standing on a desk like that one. You pick up the receiver and talk to the dead. Of course, you never really talk into the phone at all.
But if you don't talk into the phone, then...
Fixed underneath the desk is a tiny microphone with hidden wires leading to another room in the same house. That microphone picks up every word you think you are saying to the phone. Is that clear?
I think so.
Now, the dummy telephone is really a low-power radio receiving set. Somebody in another room can talk back to you after hearing what you say on the wired microphone.
Then, Mr. Templeton...
If Templeton hadn't rung Meadowvale 1212, then rest assured that same number would have rung him.
Well, then the scheme couldn't fail either way.
But, you see, there's one thing in this matter I haven't got quite clear even yet.
And what's that?
Tell me, Miss Carroll, just why did you work this whole trick? Why did you try to scare your father to death?
My father?
Templeton is your father, isn't he?
That might be rather difficult to prove, Mr. Wilmot.
By George, I admire you.
Thanks very much. I'm flattered.
Expressionless as ever. Eyes as hard and cold and blue and handsome as... Well, make your own comparison. But I knew you were guilty, of course, when I heard your fiancé was a radio technician.
You can leave Frank out of this.
Oh, you have scruples. Have I touched you?
Nothing can touch me. Not since my mother died.
Your fiancé installed the ghost mechanism and took it away today. He probably thought it was only a joke.
He did. I swear he did.
And the rest of it was plain enough. Who led Templeton to the wrong gate in the cemetery, past that woman's grave? You did. Who was the only one who could have stolen the key to this house off that key ring he took to the office? You were. You needed that key to come and go as you liked and impersonate the two voices on the phone.
Is there any need to go on with this? He killed her, you know.
You mean Templeton killed your mother?
Oh, not with a knife or a bullet or poison. All he did was break her heart. And that's no offense in law.
Steady now.
Well, I've done what I wanted to do. I've torn his whole rotten life to pieces. And there he is, gasping for breath on the floor. And I'm glad. I'm glad. Oh, God, forgive me. He is my father.
Does he know you're his daughter?
No. No, of course not. When I went to work for him as a secretary, he hadn't even seen me since I was a child. But I got near him. I worked for years to get near him. No. I wish I hadn't.
Now, look here. You've got to pull yourself together.
Why? Who cares?
That's the ambulance coming and maybe the police.
What do I care? Tell the police what you like.
My dear girl, you don't think I'll tell them anything. I'm merely an onlooker. An amateur Satan who doesn't believe in ghost voices.
Mary Ellen.
What's that?
Templeton, his eyes are open. He's trying to get up.
Mary Ellen.
It's as though he could see something that we can't
What's
see.
That he's got in his hand?
It's a revolver. He had one at the club.
He's putting it against his chest. No. I'll stop him.
Look out!
Oh, he did love her after all. And now he's tried to join her. Oh, don't let him die.
He's all right, Molly. You grabbed the gun just in time.
If he doesn't die, I'll make it up to him. I swear I'll make it up to him.
I tell you now, he's not going to die, but...
Mary Ellen.
What?
Mary Ellen.
But what? But what?
Mary Ellen.
I was just wondering, is there a ghost in this room tonight?
So closes The Dead Sleep Lightly, starring Walter Hamden, Susan Hayward, and Lee Bowman. Tonight's tale of suspense. This is your narrator, the man in black, who conveys to you Columbia's invitation to spend this half hour in suspense with us again next Tuesday. Miss Hayward appeared through the courtesy of Paramount Pictures, and Mr. Bowman appeared through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. William Spear, the producer, John Dietz, the director, Bernard Herrmann, the composer, conductor, and John Dixon Carr, the author, collaborated on tonight's Suspense.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
I see how things work around here. Weekly announcer gets bumped for Woo TV guy. Welcome back to Ricky Jin's Old Time Radio. Now enjoy this episode of Dragnet entitled Body Buried in Nursery.
Gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
NBC brings you Dragnet. You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned to a homicide detail. A man's wife has suddenly dropped from sight. On the surface, it appears only as a routine missing persons case. You start to investigate. Suspicion grows. There is evidence of possible foul play. Your job? Find the woman or find her murderer.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. Investigated and solved by the men who unrelentingly stand watch on the security of your home, your family, and your life. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Wednesday, September 15th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of homicide. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Ed Backstrand, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. I was on the way back from lunch, and it was 12:56 when I got to room 42. Homicide.
Hi, Joe. Waiting for you.
Hiya, Ben. Al.
Hi.
I hear you got something for us.
Here's a report right here. Gardner by the name of Eric Kelby called in day before yesterday. Said his wife disappeared from their home out in the valley Sunday night. Says he thinks she left him.
That happens every day, Bargetti.
Not this way, it doesn't. Walsh and I went out yesterday to interview the guy. Story doesn't add.
Why not?
None of her clothes are missing. None of her luggage. She even left her pocketbook behind, full of money. Found out from the neighbors a missing woman is a 17-year-old boy by a former marriage.
So what?
An only child. Mother dotes on the kid. Shouldn't even say goodbye to him.
How did this Eric Kelby impress you?
Pretty grouchy with Walsh and me. No cooperation.
Wants to find his wife, doesn't he?
I don't know if he does or not. It's no help, I'll tell you that.
Can I see that report a minute now?
Oh, here you are.
Agnes Trumbull Kelby, age 39.
Kelby's her second husband. First one died a little after the boy was born.
Mm-hmm. Disappeared Sunday night from her home, 546 Belasco Road, between 7 and 8 o'clock. When did Kelby call in?
Monday afternoon. Said he thought his wife might be spending the night with her sister. When he found out she wasn't, called us.
Did you meet the boy while you were out there, Borghetti?
Yeah, that's another thing. Kid came riding in on a bike while we were talking to one of the neighbors. Trying to talk to him, but the old man came out hustling him inside the house. Then he starts eating us out.
What'd he say?
Told us it was our job to find his wife, not to go prying into her stepson's affairs.
Well, that's a new slant.
How about her friends and relatives around here, Al? Any besides her sister?
Walsh located a couple of her aunts. I don't think he's checked them yet, though. I'll tell you, boys, this is one I'll bet on.
Maybe. You got the names of Mrs. Kelby's relatives?
Oh, yeah. Right over here. I wish we had a chance to talk to that boy.
Yeah. How's it feel to you, Ben?
I don't know. Notice anything else funny about the guy, Al?
I don't know. Here's those names, Joe.
Thanks.
Kelby was upset, all right. For some reason, he didn't strike me as reacting the way a normal guy reacts when his wife disappears.
All right, Al. How would you react?
Bargetti's worrying again.
Oh, now listen, boys. It's no fooling matter. This is one I'll bet on. It's a homicide.
All right. How about a copy of this report?
Yeah, where'll I get the phone? Missing persons, Bargetti. Who's that? Oh, yes. Yes. About what? Oh, sure. All right, sir. 4 o'clock. Yeah. Goodbye. That was Kelby's stepson.
What do you want?
Think something's happened to his mother.
In police work, missing persons detail is not a department separate in itself. It is organized as a part of the Homicide Bureau. According to Barghetti, who took the call, the boy said he suspected his stepfather and he didn't want him to know of any meeting between him and police officers. He would meet the officers that afternoon at 4 p.m. in a restaurant on the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Fairfax Avenue. At 3:15, Ben and I left the office and drove out to the meeting place, the Dairyland Fountain and Coffee Shop. We arrived there at 3:45. At 5:08, the Kelby boy still had not arrived.
Youngster's not very prompt.
Well, let's wait a little while longer.
Yeah. Smoke?
Yeah, thanks.
Want some more coffee?
No, thanks. I guess the boy isn't going to show.
Think something's happened?
15 minutes after we left the coffee shop, we drove up in front of the gate of the Kelby Nursery on Belasco Road. The house itself was set well back on the property, which covered about 4 acres. The entire nursery was surrounded by a 6-foot steel wire fence, and it looked like almost every available foot of ground inside was planted with some kind of a flower or shrub. Kelby met us at the gate.
Yes? What do you men want?
Police officers. Are you Mr. Kelby?
Yes. What do you want?
Well, if you'll shut those dogs up for a minute, we'd like to ask you a few questions.
I'm busy now. Can't you come back tomorrow?
It's pretty important, Mr. Kelby. I think we better talk right now.
All right, if you have to. Red, Giant, down. You too, honey. Quiet.
All right. Now, what do you want?
Mind if we come inside?
These watchdogs of mine are pretty vicious. We can talk here at the gate.
All right, Mr. Kelby. This is Sergeant Romero. My name's Friday. We've been assigned to look into your wife's disappearance.
Oh. Did you find anything yet?
Nothing definite. Maybe you can help us. Would you tell us exactly what happened the night your wife disappeared?
What do you mean, what happened?
Well, when did you last see her? When did you first notice she was gone?
We finished up Sunday night dinner about 7 o'clock, and I laid down for a nap. Agnes went out on the front porch for some air. I woke up a little before 8 and went outside to look for her. She was gone.
Nobody saw her leave, Mr. Kelby?
Not that I know of. Maybe some of our nosy neighbors, I don't know.
How about your stepson? Wasn't he around Sunday night?
Bruce? No, went out to a show with some other kids.
When did he get back from the show?
About 10, I think. Why?
Where's your stepson now?
Who are you looking for, my wife or my stepson?
Both, Mr. Kelby. Where's your stepson?
Gone. I took him over to my sister's in Alhambra. Been feeling bad since his mother disappeared. Figured the change would do him good.
When did you take him over to your sister's, Kelby?
This afternoon. What's that got to do with it?
We'd like to talk to Bruce.
No, I can't allow it. The boy's too upset. I can't allow it.
I'm afraid you're going to have to allow it.
Listen, mister, you can get off this property right now. No cops giving me sass.
Nobody's giving you sass, Kelby. We want to talk to your stepson, that's all. You might give us a clue as to the whereabouts of your wife.
And I say you can't see the boy. What's more, you cops couldn't find thorns in a rose patch. I'll get somebody else to look for Agnes. It's my business anyway. Nobody else's.
It's our business, too, if anything's happened to her.
What are you talking about?
You better get your coat, Mr. Kelby. We're taking you in for questioning.
You come through that gate, and I'm going to let these dogs go accidentally.
I'd hate to shoot the dogs. Now go on in the house and get your coat. Eric Kelby turned and made his way up the path and into the house. 5 minutes later, he came out. Without a word to either of us, he came down the path, closed the gate behind him, and got into our car. On the way back to headquarters, he chatted pleasantly about the weather, the nursery business, and his dogs. When we pulled up in front of the city hall, we met the reason for his sudden change in temperament. His lawyer was waiting for us at the door. We took Kelby to one of the interrogation rooms. His lawyer tagged along. We tried to question him, but the lawyer objected to 2 out of every 3 questions we asked. It was hopeless, and we knew it. So did the lawyer. We released Kelby, but we did get the name and address of his sister where the stepson Bruce was staying. After they left, Ben and I got back in the car and drove out to Alhambra to check on the boy.
Forget he had this in pegged right, Joe. It's a real sleeper.
Yeah. I'd like to know how the stepson missed that date with us this afternoon.
Well, if the kid called us from the house, his stepfather could have overheard him.
It's possible. Sister's house ought to be along this block, shouldn't it?
Yeah, let's see. 1408, 1406. Right, is Joe. A great cottage, 1402.
Right. Well, it's a nice looking little place, isn't it? Well kept.
Yeah, it's a nice neighborhood. Wonder how the lot prices run out here. Somebody's coming.
Yes, what is it?
Police officers, ma'am. Are you Miss Kelby?
Bertha Kelby, yes, that's my name. Why?
We talked to your brother earlier today, Miss Kelby. He said that you brought his stepson, Bruce, here to stay for a while. We'd like to see him.
Bruce? Yes, he was here till about, an hour and a half ago. I went to the store, and when I came back, he was gone.
Have you any idea where he might be, Miss Kelby?
Well, I telephoned my brother Eric's place just before you came to the door. He's not there. I don't know where he might be. I'm worried about him. He seems so upset. This business about his mother's disappearance, you know.
Would you mind if we came in and looked around, Miss Kelby?
Well, no, not at all.
We went in and looked the house over from one end to the other. There wasn't a trace of the boy. We drove back to Kelby's nursery and satisfied ourselves the boy wasn't there. Then we came back to Alhambra and we kept an eye on Miss Bertha Kelby's home until midnight. No one came or went. At 5 minutes past midnight, the lights went off in the living room and a few minutes later in the back of the house. The next morning, when Ben and I checked in for work as usual at 8 o'clock, we met with Captain of Homicide, Frank Kearney.
What makes you two so positive there has been any foul play in this Kelby thing?
That's just it, Cap. We're not positive. It's a whole setup. It smells bad.
For instance?
That lawyer. If a man's innocent, he doesn't need a lawyer to sit with him in the interrogation room and tell him not to answer questions. Number two, that kid's telephone call.
Maybe he doesn't get along with his stepfather. It happens, you know. Maybe he's trying to get back at him for something or other.
Maybe. Then why is Kelby hiding him out?
You sure he's hiding him out?
No other way to take it, Cap.
The Kelby woman walked away from her home Sunday night. Nobody saw her. She took nothing with her. No clothes, no luggage, no money. You checked with the family doctor?
Yesterday. He told us Mrs. Kelby was in perfect health. We double-checked the wanderer's file and the repeater's file and missing persons. Couldn't find her name in either one.
How about her relatives in town?
Haven't had a chance to talk to them yet, Cap. We'll check them this morning.
Well, one thing's certain. The woman couldn't have gone very far.
We checked the sheriff's office, the jails, the hospitals.
Sent out a teletype and an APB. Every cop in the city has her description. She's been gone almost 4 days, but nobody's seen her. How does that add up to you?
It doesn't. You better move on it. Check every one of Mrs. Kelby's friends and relatives.
Right, Frank.
Then try the neighbors. As long as I've been a cop, neighbors have been able to tell everything about anyone.
All that day, Ben and I made the rounds. First stop was the Western National Bank, where Mrs. Kelby maintained her account. Her savings statement showed a total balance of $31,564.17. Her separate checking account had a balance of $842.71. At the Farmers Mutual, we found the record of an insurance policy issued to Agnes Trumbull Kelby. It was a 20-pay life policy covering the insured in the amount of $30,000. The beneficiary was listed as the insured son, Bruce Trumbull Kelby, if living upon the receipt of such due proof. If not, the insured's husband, Eric J. Kelby. By the time we finished checking her financial status, the odds were piling up fast. From only casual reports, we knew that Eric Kelby was a frugal man. If he was greedy as well, if he wanted or needed money badly enough to kill, then he had all the motives necessary to murder his wife. Maybe his stepson, too. Ben and I started to make the rounds of Mrs. Kelby's friends and relatives. Our first stop was at the apartment of Agnes Kelby's sister, a talkative maiden lady in her early 60s.
Agnes just isn't that kind. Oh, I'm worried sick about this. I really am. And Bruce, the poor lad, he must be heartsick. And Eric, what does Eric say about all this?
He says he thinks his wife left him.
Left him? Why, that's ridiculous. How strange.
Can you think of any good reason why your sister would leave Mr. Kelby?
Why, no. They had tiffs, of course, small ones. But of course there was that argument about Bruce. The two of them always seem to be arguing about Bruce.
How do you mean, ma'am?
Oh, well, raising the boy and all, you know. Last time I talked to them, they were tiffing about whether or not Bruce should be paid for working in the nursery for Eric. And the strangest thing, Eric seemed to be so upset about it all. Imagine. All on account of paying the boy a few dollars for good, honest work in that silly nursery. Well, you know, I'm the outspoken kind, and I just told Eric. Eric, I said, don't be an old meanie. Pay the boy.
That was the extent of the information which Mrs. Kelby's sister had to offer. Next, we called on an aunt, Mrs. James D. Trumbull, 83 years old. She could hardly understand our questions, let alone answer them. She hadn't seen her niece, Agnes, in a year. After that, we paid a visit to one of Mrs. Kelby's friends, a Mrs. Lillian Humboldt.
Well, I'm sorry, Sergeant, but I can't think of any good reason why she would leave him. Unless that silly business about Bruce got out of hand. You know, maybe Eric is just a little jealous of the boy.
Next, we called on Daisy McLeod, who worked as a day maid for Mrs. Kelby.
Officer, what Mr. and Mrs. Kelby thought, what they said, what they did, it's none of my business. I come in the morning, I do my work, I do it well. I'm not the nosy type, and I don't pry. I take
half an hour for lunch, and when I'm through, I take my pay, and I don't expect tips, and I take the bus home. I'm not the peeking through the keyhole kind, sneaking around corners listening. But what I couldn't tell you about that man...
Exactly what do you mean, Miss McLeod?
Oh, he's a hard man, you know. They're always arguing about the boy. Bruce this, Bruce that. He's a nice boy, I think. He's never done anything to me. Oh, but the arguments. Him and her all the time. Should the boy be paid for working? Shouldn't he? Why? Why not?
When Ben and I finished with a list of Mrs. Kelby's friends, relatives, and employees, we started out on the neighbors. None of them saw Mrs. Kelby after 6 p.m. the night she disappeared. Two of the neighbors said they saw the porch light burning after 7 p.m., but both said the porch was empty. Mrs. Kelby was not sitting in her chair at the usual time after dinner. According to them, that was one of her habits. It was 10 minutes to 6 by the time Ben and I got back to the office. The light was still burning in Captain Kearney's office.
Full day, Joe. Not a morning.
Yeah. I wonder what the captain's hanging around for.
Let's find out.
Get anything?
Pretty good look, yeah.
Good. I've got some more for you. Just walked in 5 minutes ago.
What do you mean, Frank? Who walked in?
Bruce Kelby. He's waiting in the next room.
We went in the next room and met Bruce Kelby. He was small for a 17-year-old, dark-haired and a little on the sickly side. He told us that he couldn't keep the date he made with us on the phone because his stepfather apparently did overhear the conversation and drove him directly to his sister's home in Alhambra. We asked him why he was so sure that his stepfather was responsible for his mother's sudden disappearance.
For one thing, all three of us usually go to the early show on Sunday night. Eric, Mom, and me. But last Sunday, Eric said he wasn't feeling good and he wanted Mom to stay home and take care of him. Then he told me to go on ahead to the show, so I did.
What time did you get home, son?
About 9:30, quarter to 10.
What was your stepfather doing when you got home?
Sitting in the living room, reading the paper.
You notice anything unusual about the way he acted?
Well, he was nervous and jumpy, more than usual, I think.
Anything else?
Yes, sir. When I came in through the front yard, I noticed the dogs had mud all over their paws. They'd been out somewhere in the nursery plots. And they won't go out in the plots unless Eric's with them. He doesn't want them to trample the seedlings.
What would your stepfather be doing out in the nursery at night? Does he usually do some work at night?
No, sir. None of the plots are even lighted. Only the greenhouses.
And the paths in the greenhouses are usually graveled, aren't they? No mud around.
It's my job to see that the greenhouse paths are kept graveled. I know they're not muddy. I fixed them the day before, Saturday.
What do you think it means, son?
I don't know. I don't want to think about it. I just know he's done something. He's done something to her.
Did your stepfather give you any reason for keeping you away from the police officers the other day?
No, sir. He said people were getting nosy, and he said it might be better for me over at Aunt Bertha's. She's his sister.
Do you think your Aunt Bertha might know where your mother is?
No, we hardly ever see her. We don't know her well at all.
We've heard your mother and your stepfather argued about whether you should be paid for your work in the nursery.
When I started to work for him, he promised he'd pay me. I was saving up to buy a 31 Model A. And then after a couple of months, when he didn't pay me, I asked him. He told me I ought to be glad to work for him for nothing.
And your mother argued with him over that?
Sure, it was her money that bought the nursery anyway.
How'd you get away from your aunt's place last night?
Well, Bertha had some shopping to do and she left me alone. She locked the door to my room. Even the screen over the window in my room was nailed down, but I kicked it out and got away. I stayed at a friend's house last night.
Thought about where you're going to stay tonight?
I don't know. But I'm not going home. And I'm not going back to Bertha's place either. I'll get a room.
How'd you like to stay at my house a few days?
Sure nice of you, sir. Maybe I'd better not. Mom might not like it.
Oh, I'll take care of that. Now let's hop out and get some dinner.
Sure darn nice of you, sir.
All right, son. Come with me.
What do you think, Joe?
He could be lying. Yeah.
Now what, Cap? Shall we bring Kelby in again?
No, not yet. He's found out by now from his sister that the boy's gone. He probably figures the police station is the first place he'd come.
Wouldn't do much good pulling him in now, Ben. We couldn't even question him. 10 to 1 his lawyer'd be waiting for us when we got back.
That's the problem. How do we get to this Kelby without his lawyer finding out?
Well, what about the early morning, Cap? Say tomorrow, about 5 or 6 a.m. Think you'd be looking for us then?
Yeah,
That might do it.
If we can just get by that pack of hounds he owns without waking the whole neighborhood, might work.
If we could just question him alone, I got an idea it wouldn't take much to make him cop out.
All right, give it a try. Get out there in the early morning and bring him in for questioning as quietly as possible. I'll be in at 6 a.m. If you want me before then, call me at home.
All right, Frank.
Kelby's got a smart lawyer. It's going to be plenty hard to convict him without a body and corroborating evidence.
He's got 4 acres out there, Cap. You can hide a lot of bodies in 4 acres.
Well, that's what I mean. This case isn't ending. It's just beginning.
The next morning, Ben and I met at the office about a few minutes past 4 a.m. We had a cup of coffee and a donut at an all-night restaurant, and then we started for the Kelby place out on Belasco Road. We took 4 pounds of fresh horse meat with us to keep the dogs quiet if they raised a fuss. It was 28 minutes past 4 when Ben pulled the car to a stop a few hundred feet from the gate to the Kelby nursery. We got out of the car and made our way down the road to the gate. I reached in and tried the latch. It was padlocked. The dogs started in. Okay, Ben, looks like we'll have to jump the fence. Toss some of that horse meat over to him.
Yeah, here.
That's it. Come on, let's climb.
Keep an eye on those hounds. Looks like they could chew your leg off.
Yeah. Here comes a third one, Ben. Toss some more meat.
Yeah. There you are, boy. Go get it. Go get it, boy. There.
Look, Ben, light's going on in the house.
Come on, let's make it fast.
Who is it? Who's there? I'll set the dogs on you.
Police officers, Mr. Kelby.
What? What are you doing out here this time of night?
You're under arrest, Kelby. Get your coat.
You cops are asking for a peck of trouble.
Get your coat.
Where's my stepson? What have you done with him?
What have you done with your wife?
You're going to pay for this. I'll have your jobs.
That's not the first time we heard that, Kelby. Let's go. Light's burning in the captain's office.
Yeah. All right, Kelby, in here.
You'll pay for this, mark my word.
Ben, take him in the office here and stay with him. I'll see if Frank's in yet.
Right, Joe. Come on, Kelby, inside.
Friday, you bring in Kelby?
He's down in the interrogation room. Ben's with him.
Somebody saw you.
Don't think so.
They must have. Kelby's lawyer's sitting in the next room.
Kelby again refused to answer any questions without the advice of his attorney. We released him. That day, Captain Kearney sent out 2 men to keep an eye on the nursery and report on all of Kelby's movements. Shortly after 7 o'clock that night, just after nightfall, we tried once again to bring in Kelby for questioning without his lawyer's knowledge. It didn't work. A little after we booked him, his lawyer obtained a writ of habeas corpus. We had to release him again. The 2 men assigned to stake out the Kelby place reported definitely that somebody was tipping the lawyer whenever unknown visitors showed up at the nursery and drove off with Kelby. There was nothing we could do about it. The next morning, Kearney came up with a lead.
I had a long talk with the boy last night. Accidentally, I think he's given us a pretty good lead.
Yeah?
There's only one way we'll ever get a conviction. That's by finding the body and evidence to tie Kelby in.
Yeah, that'll do it. Where do we start looking?
In a new rose bed next to one of the greenhouses in Kelby's nursery.
Hmm?
The kid came up with it last night.
How come?
First, Kelby's crazy about saving a dollar and making one.
Yeah.
In the nursery trade, especially where you have a limited area to work in, like Kelby, you cultivate every foot of ground. Every bit of soil you got is planted with something.
Mm-hmm.
Kelby's not the type to waste anything. Especially he's not the kind that would let ground lie fallow when he could plant something that might bring in a few dollars next season. Bruce tells me his stepfather has every inch of those 4 acres planted. Every inch. Except a 6 by 9 foot plot of ground in that rose garden.
Oh, that sounds like a long shot to me, Frank.
The boy said he prepared that piece of ground for planting late Saturday afternoon. His stepfather wanted it ready for Sunday morning. The plot of ground's still vacant.
Might have planted it yesterday, Cap. When's the last time you checked?
Before I came to work this morning. I called the men on stakeout next to the nursery. They told me the plot's still empty.
Mm-hmm. It's worth a chance, Frank. When do we look it over?
Tonight. I don't want Kelby or his lawyer to know a thing until we find that body.
Well, how are we going to work it?
We'll order up a crew from the crime lab. They can take probings through that plot and all around it. They can tell us without any guesswork how deep that ground's been worked over lately.
When do you want to start?
Be here in the office at 8:30 tonight. If my hunches are any good, we'll find a body.
We It was 9:10 that night when we got to the Kelby place. Lieutenant Lee Jones and his assistants, Kearney, Ben, and two other men from homicide. The men on stakeout told us that Kelby had left about 20 minutes before in a dark blue coupe. Ben brought along the usual supply of horse meat for the dog, so we didn't have any trouble there. We found the empty plot of ground in the rose bed next to the greenhouse, exactly as Bruce described it to Kearney.
Ground's been worked over all right, boys. At least 4 to 5 feet down.
All right, Lee, let's start digging. Romero, take care of the dogs. Watson, grab one of these shovels.
Right, Cap.
Hey, Gilbert said these dogs were vicious, didn't he?
Yeah, why?
Look at these hounds. They're no more vicious than a lively colt, look.
Higgins, get that light over here, will you? Thanks.
What is it, Lee?
Let me see. Teeth. Set of false teeth.
Been in the ground long?
Don't think so, judging from the shape they're in.
How far down would you say, Yarley? A
couple of feet. Ground's real soft.
Lee, come here a minute.
What is it?
Body. Here's the shoulder.
All right, you men over here with Watson. Get the dirt off the face. Romero, you got a picture of the Kelby woman?
Yeah, Cap. Let's see. I hear you.
Thanks. Get the light down here.
Aren't you paid off, Frank? That's her. Ben and I went back to the car and notified communications to broadcast a want for murder on Eric Kelby. His description, together with a description of the car and license number of the car he was driving, was rebroadcast every 15 minutes. Then we went back to check the house. We found the front door unlocked. We went inside and looked around. In one bedroom, we found clothes scattered over the bed and the floor. There was only one old suit remaining in the closet. On the table next to the bed, we found an airline's timetable. We got to the phone and notified communications to alert all police details at railroad stations, bus terminals, and airlines, and then to send out an APB on the teletype. After that, we checked with the airlines. One of them told us that a man answering Kelby's description had booked passage for Mexico City. The plane was scheduled to take off at 10:40 that night from Burbank Airport. Ben's watch said 10:04. We called the detail at the airport and alerted them. Then we drove over to check in person. It was 10:35 p.m. when Ben and I took up our positions just inside Gate 3, where passengers were boarding Flight 72 for Mexico City.
He's cutting it close, Joe. Got about 4 minutes more to make that plane.
We waited. The crowd got thicker as departure time came closer. At 10:39, Eric Kelby came through the main entrance, across the terminal, through Gate 3, into a pair of handcuffs.
I don't understand. What does this mean?
We found your wife's body, Kelby.
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
In the rose patch next to the greenhouse. Your lawyer can't help this time.
Mexico City. Would have been a nice trip. Expensive.
I'll plead insanity. I didn't know what I was doing.
Be a nice vacation next year, Joe, Mexico City. I'm going to talk to my wife about it.
I didn't mean it. She slapped me. We were arguing about the boy. I didn't mean it.
I don't know if you did or not, Kelby, but you killed her. Come on. You missed your plane.
The story you have just heard is true. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
Eric Kelby was tried and convicted of murder in the first degree. He is now awaiting execution in the lethal gas chamber at the state penitentiary. You have just heard the 14th in a new series of authentic cases transcribed from official files. Technical advice for Dragnet comes from the office of W.A. Wharton, Acting Chief of Police, Los Angeles Police Department.
Tonight's program is dedicated to William J. Weston, Jr. of the Washington, D.C. Police Department, who on the evening of March 4th, 1945, gave his life so that yours might be more secure. Dragnet came to you from Los Angeles. If you enjoyed tonight's production of Dragnet, you'll want to listen to Richard Diamond, private detective, as played by the screen's romantic tough guy, Dick Powell.
The Pet Milk Show, usually heard at this time, has moved to a new time period on Sunday nights. Be sure to hear Larry Douglas and Kay Armon on the new Pet Milk Show tomorrow night on NBC. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Thank
thank you for listening to Ricky Jin's Old Time Radio. Join us again next week at the same time on the mighty KONR. Don't forget to play What Will Mrs. Thompson Say at LGAB.com. Now, stay tuned for the Sasquatch Report.